KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Media mergers aren't always big news, but this week, satellite radio giants XM and Sirius announced plans to join hands. What makes this proposed merger significant is that they're the only two satellite radio services. So will that mean less competition and higher prices for satellite radio listeners? Or will it simply allow subscribers to one service access to the other and thus provide greater consumer choice? As radio continues to evolve, what does the proposed merger, along with internet radio and podcasts, mean for the future of the medium? Radio's Brave New World, our focus next on 4. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Sirius Satellite Radio has Howard Stern. XM has Major League Baseball and Oprah. XM and Sirius are the only two satellite radio providers, and after slugging it out as competitors, they've now decided they want to become one. Listeners to Howard Stern on Sirius would now get baseball on XM and vice versa. Such a deal. The Sirius-XM merger proposal has industry analysts and government regulators fully dialed in. On the one hand, the merger would mean no more competition, something regulators normally frown upon. On the other, XM and Sirius argue that satellite radio consumers will win because they'll gain access to that much more programming. But the merger proposal is just one of several new phenomena that are pushing radio into new terrain. In fact, radio may be moving off terrain somewhat altogether. Internet radio, podcasts, and satellite services all mean that old-fashioned terrestrial radio has plenty of new challenges. We're going to bring a variety of viewpoints to all of this topic over the course of the next hour, but we want to start with what has to happen in terms of government approval before an XM-Sirius merger could go forward. Joining us to do that first, Howard Liberman. He's a partner in the firm of Drinker, Biddle & Reith, where he specializes in communications law. He's formerly an attorney at the Federal Communications Commission. Mr. Liberman, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. 10 years ago, when XM and Sirius came into being, the FCC, when granting those licenses, said that the two of them would not be permitted to acquire control one over the other. So now, 10 years later, that's exactly what these two companies want to do. How big a hurdle is that they have to overcome now before the FCC?
Well, that hurdle is not their biggest hurdle. The FCC frequently waives its rules upon a showing. If the FCC finds that it's in the public interest to waive a rule, they waive a rule, or they can waive a rule. So that's not their biggest hurdle.
The biggest hurdle then would be what?
Would be the antitrust approval from, we presume it'll be the Department of Justice. They have to file what's called a pre-merger notification under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act and notify the government that they plan to merge. The way that process works is if you don't hear from the government after so many days, you can merge. But, of course, in this case, everyone believes that they will receive a letter which is called a second request letter, which, going on page after page, basically says, send us tons of information from your internal files. So the antitrust regulators will do a thorough review of this proposal first.
So it has to go through a two-step process, first from the Justice Department and the antitrust division of that, and then on to the FCC.
It's simultaneous.
It's simultaneous, okay.
Right.
But it has to clear both those
hurdles.
Exactly. Right. So part of the question has to do now with what is competition. The companies are making the argument, XM and Sirius, that there will still be competition, even if they are one company, because there are all these other entities out there, whether that's internet radio or podcasts. There's this sort of brave and broad new world of audio entertainment. Do you think that's likely to be a successful argument?
I do. The essence of antitrust law in a merger proposal is how do you define the market? And, of course, if you define the market as satellite subscription radio, it's the only two merging in one. That would be like Coke and Pepsi merging. It would never be allowed. They're trying to define the market into or as what they call the rapidly evolving audio entertainment marketplace. And that would include iPods, terrestrial radio, AM and FM radio, HD radio, which will be multiple channels as time goes on, is in some cases, wireless broadband internet radio, streaming of radio stations. I can listen to your station right now here in Washington easily and for free. And so they're defining the market as music into people's ears, or audio content into people's ears.
And what about the pushback on that, even if you have that sort of, accept that broader context, that there is more competition than just satellite versus satellite company? The NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, for example, has said this is just rewarding a failing company. This is just saying that an industry that champions Howard Stern, you know, should be allowed to form a monopoly. It sounds like you're skeptical that that argument will carry much weight with the FCC.
Correct. And first of all, it was only Sirius who championed Howard Stern, not XM. So they're championing Oprah.
Right.
But two things, if you're looking at the FCC process, you mentioned the rule from 10 years ago that the two companies couldn't merge. There's also a rule that requires interoperability, which is that if you buy one receiver, you should be able to change companies and listen to the other. Well, that doesn't exist now. And one of the arguments XM and Sirius will make is that this merger will create, in essence, interoperability. So, for example, I, now an XM subscriber, could listen to NFL football, which I can't now, or Howard Stern, or whatever they have on, and vice versa with Sirius subscribers. So they are proposing public interest benefits from the merger at the FCC.
So in the end, your thought would be that there's a pretty persuasive argument to be, not only for that there still will be competition from all these other forces like podcasting and so forth, but that this meets the broadest test, which is that it's in the consumer's best interest.
Right. The showing at the Justice Department is an antitrust analysis, and economists get involved, and the standard is competitiveness. The showing at the FCC is the public interest, which is a different standard. What's in the public interest?
Howard Lieberman joined us this morning to provide us an update on the regulatory process that will be going forward first with XM and Sirius as they propose their new satellite merger. Mr. Lieberman, thanks for giving us that update this morning.
Thank you.
And now let's bring in the rest of our panel this morning to talk about not only the proposed merger between XM and Sirius, but what the implications are for the new world of radio and all of these new sorts of new technologies that are changing the shape of radio as we know it. Joining us, Barry Parr. He's senior analyst with Jupiter Research, which is a technology market research firm. Mr. Parr, good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. Joining us as well, Skip Pizzi. He writes a column called The Big Picture for Radio World Newspaper, and he's also the manager of technology policy at Microsoft in Washington, D.C. Skip Pizzi, good morning.
Morning, Dave. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. Ellen Lee is with us as well. She's technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us as well, Doug Kay, he's executive director of the Conversations Network. He joins us from the Integrated Media Association meeting that's taking place in Washington this week. Doug Kay, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Let's begin first by talking about the sort of broader competitive field that we heard Howard Lieberman suggesting and that he thinks will be sort of the winning argument here, that even if these two satellite companies merge and there's only one satellite radio provider, that there's so much else going on in the radio world that will be a winning argument. Barry Parr, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a reasonable case to be made that's true. First of all, these two satellite radio companies have had a tough time just competing with free radio as it is now. And the other piece that's really emerging is iPod and other MP3 players. And now you've got cars that are coming out with satellite radio installed, but they're also coming out with connectors to plug in your MP3 player. And so you're not only competing with music that people have on their iPods already, but in fact, things like podcasts, radio programs that they're downloading off of the Internet onto their iPods.
Doug Kay, walk us through a little bit about what some of those podcasts are. For those who aren't familiar with the term, and podcasts are essentially a TiVo-like device for radio. It allows you to get programming when you want it and play it back when you want it. You direct something called the Conversations Network. Tell us a little bit about what that whole broad new spectrum of offerings are.
I think you've got it right. The primary concept of podcasting is to give you the opportunity of when you want to listen to it and where you want to listen to it, and also because the cost of transmission and distribution are so extremely low, it significantly broadens the offerings that are available. If you look at terrestrial radio, you're limited by transmitters. Even satellite radio is limited by a fixed number of channels, whereas the Internet opens that up to virtually everybody who can has any ability to produce audio or video on the internet.
And it could come from any source. If there's a great talk going on at the Commonwealth Club or whatever here in San Francisco, that's the kind of thing that would be now available?
Well, that's one of many. It can be anything from something fairly organized such as that to the audio or even the video of YouTube, for example. So you get an incredibly wide range of offerings. You have, once again, the problem of figuring out what it is you want to listen to or watch, but it's virtually unlimited.
And Skip Pizzi, what does this mean then for satellite radio with this broad array of technologies and programming that's available? What does satellite radio have to do to make their own mark within this broadly competitive arena?
Well, they've been trying that, of course, for their entire existence, both together and separately. And I think that it's easy to say, well, they're part of this big audio marketplace out there, but they are really different in one respect, different from everything except terrestrial radio, in that they are a push service in a scarce environment. And all those other internet services and things that we're talking about, as rich and interesting as they are, and I'm certainly a big fan of them myself, you have to really go out there and find the stuff. And podcasting makes it a little easier to, once you do find something, to keep getting the same stuff. But it's a pretty different model than the push broadcast that terrestrial radio and satellite radio pretty much by themselves have access to.
And by push, Skip, just to be clear about the terminology, you mean simply the programming that comes at you and you can just receive rather than having to go find it.
Exactly. And there's a finite number of channels that are always there. And you know that you turn it on and you just say, let's see what's on. Sometimes now there are some new services, new devices with satellite radio that have been kind of controversial, actually, that would allow you to just time shift that. But otherwise, it's still all pushed at you as it is in terrestrial radio. And once you get to the end of the dial, if you haven't heard anything you like, well, you're done. You know, then maybe you move on to something that you've pulled down, anything from buying a CD and the store the old-fashioned way, to something that you downloaded from the internet or an iTunes site or something like that, or a podcast.
Skip Pizzi writes a column called The Big Picture for Radio World. He also manages technology policy at Microsoft in Washington, D.C. Ellen Lee, technology reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. What about that? I would think of myself, for example, as someone who would just as soon have programming come at me and not have to go out and find it. Is part of what we're also seeing a sort of generational change, and that people who are younger are that much more assertive about going out and finding programming as opposed to being more passive and waiting to get it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think people are still, young people are still listening to the radio. I think there's a certain laziness factor where you can just turn it on and it's right there. But the exciting thing about podcasts is there's just such an array of content that you might not be able to find on traditional radio stations. It just runs the gamut from health type podcasts to sports to everything, the little minutia that you might not have the space for on radio you could find on a podcast.
And given that environment, again, Barry Parr, what's the challenge then for not only satellite radio, but also terrestrial radio, old-fashioned radio, if we can call it that, within, again, this broad array? What sort of challenges are before those older forms, as well as the new with satellite, that they now have to contend with?
Well, certainly, I mean, you know, iPod and MP3 players represent a big segment of that. So there are about 37 million people in the U.S. right now who have iPods. And in the next 5 years, that number is going to be about 100 million. And you can see one of the things that's driving that is a lot of companies are putting MP3 on cell phones. And so a whole new generation of people who might not have had it with them otherwise are certainly going to have it. So you're not only competing with podcast, which is still a relatively high-end phenomenon. It's only about 5% of internet users are listening to podcasts, and most of them on their computers, not on their iPods.
But more people actually have iPods than subscribe to satellite radio, right?
That's right. So it's about 37 million iPod users, about 10 million satellite radio subscribers. But with iPod and MP3 players, what you're also competing with is people listening to their own music collections. You know, people just putting it on shuffle play, listening to their favorite songs, you know, in a random fashion, which for most people is going to be their favorite radio station. And I think that's a big problem.
Barry Parr is senior analyst with Jupiter Research. He joins us this morning along with Skip Heasy of the Big Picture column for Radio World, Doug Kay, executive director of the Conversations Network, and Ellen Lee, technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. So, Doug Kay, for local stations, and full disclosure, we should mention that Forum, the program that people are listening to right now, as Mr. Lieberman mentioned at the beginning of the program, is available, streamed on the Internet. It's available on Sirius Satellite as well. So we're KQED and the Forum program are a part of all this. But as part of the solution, if that's the right word, for old-fashioned radio stations to be local, 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 because that's not what's available necessarily on satellite?
Yeah, I mean, that's the struggle that everyone is talking about here in Boston this week, which is, what is the future of the terrestrial stations? How are they going to survive, particularly in public media? The obvious thing is what's referred to as hyperlocal. It's the one thing that seems to be the niche that the radio stations can solve. Beyond that, the question that's being asked is, to what extent is public radio the local station, the portal for NPR and PRI? If you ask most people, what do you listen to? They say, I listen to NPR, not realizing that KQED is not NPR, it is not PRI, it is a local affiliate. But everybody's struggling with that. And what's happening is that the local stations are going beyond terrestrial, and they're saying, what can we do in the world of podcasts? Can we create content that doesn't work on the air but works through podcasts? Can we monetize? Are we able to charge for content or perhaps sell sponsorships in podcasts where we're not able to do that on our terrestrial licenses?
Doug, but the economics of that then are, for local stations, if someone can listen to Morning Edition, let's say on NPR, over the Internet, or they can listen to Forum, for that matter, over Sirius Satellite, they don't make the connection to the local station and therefore aren't perhaps as responsive to our old friend, the Pledge Drive.
Absolutely. And I think that, as a member of KQED, I'm aware of it through Pledge Drives, but I don't think everybody is, the fact that KQED has to pay quite a bit for that national programming. And in some ways, the local stations see that as a tax. NPR is not always everybody's friend in this ecosystem.
Let's come back to the FCC for a moment in all of this. There's a line from the Communications Act of 1934 that says that broadcast operations have to operate in what's called the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And something like the proposed merger between XM and Sirius has to pass that test. It has to pass the test of being in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. As you look at that standard, Ellen Lee, the word that strikes me, which probably wasn't what the authors of that act some 70 years ago were thinking about, is the word convenience. Because increasingly, this is all, so you can make the argument that all of these things are about convenience, so why shouldn't they happen?
Absolutely. It's so easy just to go online and listen to stream a radio station. It's so easy to subscribe or to download a podcast right now. You can program it actually just to automatically subscribe, and that way you don't even have to think about it. It's just right there on your computer, ready for you to listen when you want it to.
Ellen Lee, technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's chime in on that. What else is going to be significant about appealing to the convenience of listeners? Barry Parr, what do you think?
I think, going back to that, the idea that was raised earlier, which was that radio ultimately is in many ways a passive medium. And we need to be realistic about the degree to which people are going to be interested in doing their own programming of radio and picking their own shows. Especially since, for the most part, they're listening to radio in the car. And fiddling with your iPod is not exactly the best thing you ought to do when you're driving.
And is that part of what Sirius and XM can draw upon, do you think, in the future, Skip Heasy, that it's a car medium? And if a single car satellite device is installed that allows people to get both XM and Sirius, that's what they have to count on? It's all about cars in the end?
Well, ultimately, that was their first target. And their biggest target in this country, somewhat uniquely around the world, we have about as much listening to the radio in the car as we do anywhere else, home or work. It's fairly equivalent on all three. Very different in a lot of other countries, but we're a big car radio listening market, and satellite radio targeted that first. It's also the easiest way to get a satellite signal from the sky, because you have to have a pretty unobstructed view of the satellites for that to work. which is something that satellite radio folks pioneered. The idea of a tiny little satellite dish is still fairly impressive from a technological perspective, and things that are kind of buried invisibly in the roof of a car working as satellite. That was science fiction 10, 20 years ago. And so the fact that cars work well for this is obviously was part of their whole business model. And there's nothing more convenient, to get back to your earlier question, than just being able to turn something on and have it immediately start playing. And that's what radio does. Radio, terrestrial radio particularly, I think sets the bar very high for those criteria that you mentioned. And I sort of rewrite them today as being something you need. It needs to be cheap, ubiquitous, and reliable. And FM radio particularly really is hard to beat on that score. Satellite radio is obviously a pay service. It's not very reliable inside buildings. And so it's not really ubiquitous either in terms of where you can get it, and you have to have a specific radio for the specific service. Now, those radios typically, not all of them, but most of them have AM and FM on them too, and so that's where you can kind of mix and match between your local and national service. But I would say that terrestrial radio still has – it's their game to lose – because it's not just about localism, it's just about being different. Now, different from the national sort of conglomerate service. And localism is a part of that, but there are other services that I listen to services that online and on the air that I just like because they're different and I can't find them anywhere else on terrestrial or satellite radio.
Barry Parr, you wanted to chime in.
The other thing I wanted to raise is that satellite radio is also dealing with a demographic issue, which is most of their listeners or buyers tend to be older and more affluent. And they really rolled out this service by putting those receivers for free trials in luxury cars. They've been trying to expand their market by moving basically to a wider and broader audience. And it's unclear whether or not they're going to be successful. We've had some concerns at Jupiter that, in fact, what's going to happen is that their churn rate, the percentage of subscribers they lose every month, is going to increase. So as their audience ages and they may not be able to move to a younger, less affluent audience, we have to keep in mind that the people that are listening to iPods and internet radio are significantly younger than the general audience as well. And so you could see that the demographic momentum is really in favor of MP3.
And so in the end, is it not surprising to you that these two entities would struggle so, XM and Sirius, because they're still losing money? I mean, they're wanting to merge for a reason.
That's correct. They are both trying to expand to profitability in a market whose size, to be honest, right now is still uncertain.
Barry Parr is someone who is a senior analyst for Jupiter Research. He joins us this hour along with Skip Pizzi, Ellen Lee, and Doug Kay. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment about the future of radio, both terrestrial, internet. We'll talk about podcasting and the merger, proposed merger between XM and Sirius when we return. We welcome your calls and thoughts on this topic as well. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Or we'll open our phone lines as well now, and you can call in and participate in our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the proposed merger between the satellite giants XM and Sirius, what that may portend not only for satellite radio, but also for the world of radio in general, as well as the other new developments that have been taking place in the radio world over the last several years, from podcasting to internet radio and beyond. Joining us this hour to talk about that, Barry Parr, senior analyst with Jupiter Research, Skip Pizzi, who writes a column called The Big Picture for Radio World, Ellen Lee, technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Doug Kay, executive director of the Conversations Network. And we welcome your participation in our program as well. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And let's go first to Wanda this morning, who joins us in Palo Alto. Wanda, go ahead.
Hello, I'm from the generation who likes to listen to radio simply to be surprised by what's going to be on, rather than to tune until I find something I know I'll like. But the other thing that I get when I get a surprise about what other people think is important is I might get a little notice that there has been an earthquake or there is a flood warning in the next 2 hours in my neighborhood, and I'm wondering, have the broadcasters given any thought at all to their obligation to warn the public, and what's going to happen when someone records their listening program for the day, plugs their iPod into their ears, and walks off and is completely unavailable for that sort of announcement anymore?
Wanda, thank you. Really interesting observations. There was the famous example, I can't recall if, I believe it was a Clear Channel station in the Dakotas or somewhere that didn't provide a warning because Clear Channel doesn't provide that sort of service. Let's talk about that and what that means again in terms of localism, Barry Parr.
Well, it's obviously really important. I mean, radio stations are, in fact, rooted in their communities, literally. I mean, one of the challenges we have in the Bay Area, though, is, in fact, that, the Bay Area is a very large media market, and our communities are pretty small. Now, I live on coastal San Mateo County, and, in fact, we don't have a radio station of our own out there. We don't have TV coverage. You know, we've got a weekly newspaper. And so it's really difficult. I mean, a lot of local communities in this larger market really are not getting the information they need. There are probably a dozen cities between San Francisco and San Jose that would have daily newspapers if they didn't exist in this particular market.
And Doug Kay, is that a gap that podcasting can provide to communities like Barry is referring to?
Well, unfortunately not. I don't think there's much in podcasting that would allow it to respond to real-time events such as Wanda's describing.
And what about then what would you say the strength that podcasting does provide? Is it the sense of surprise that Wanda was also referring to?
Well, I guarantee Wanda that if she were to explore the world of podcasting, she would be very surprised. There's quite a bit out there. But I think it's not quite the serendipity type of experience that she's used to experiencing with terrestrial radio.
Ellen Lee, you make the argument also that a sense of discovery and surprise is part of what's exciting about this brave new world.
Exactly. I think originally when people listened to the radio, they were looking for new information. They were also trying to discover new artists, new songs, new music. And you can definitely do that through podcasts. The downside, of course, is that you do have to search through it. You have to find what you want. And there is a lot of stuff out there that is very amateur, that isn't very interesting. And the irony, of course, is that if you look at iTunes and you look at what the top podcasts are, they're from the people that you recognize. They're from NPR. They're from ESPN and the Discovery Channel. Those are the ones that are the most popular still.
So that sort of quality, if you will, professionalism, call it what you will, can be the calling card for more traditional media?
Exactly. It's a name that people recognize. They know that if they download that podcast, they will probably get something interesting that they are interested in.
And Skip Peasy, is that, again, sort of what the argument that traditional broadcasters need to make, that because it's such a huge world with so much going on and there's so much coming at you, if you can identify, whether it's National Public Radio or whatever, as sort of a safe harbor that you know you're going to get a certain kind of product from, that's a useful sort of trademarking device?
Absolutely, and that's the branding challenge that broadcasters need to put forward right now and are trying to do. I would mention, just to clarify, that it's not that Clear Channel didn't provide that service, which was in Minot, North Dakota, that you referred to earlier. That was a failure. That Clear Channel and every terrestrial broadcaster are obligated to provide those kinds of services by FCC rule, and this particular case, they failed to do so, and it was in the middle of the night and so forth, and there's a lot of reasons and excuses and so forth, but it's caused a lot of discussion through the industry as to how to not let that kind of thing happen again, which it shouldn't. And there were some issues of regulatory. They followed up with some process on that because it was a failure of the system that's supposed to be in place. Satellite radio doesn't have those same kind of obligations because they are a national service. But radio's localism is still becoming, I think, a unique feature that has to be respected and should be, I think, promoted in this increasingly noisy environment.
And to Jerry next, who joins us this morning from Olema. Jerry, go ahead.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm a community radio broadcaster, as a matter of fact, have been for over 20 years. And, you know, the thing that concerns me most about this, and I'd like, and you've already started addressing all my talking points, is the, you know, the continuing centralization of media in like an XM or Sirius type of service, where it pushes small artists out, the upcoming artists, the very talented and young upcoming artists that only get exposure on local media outlets. And, of course, there is the emergency communication aspects of a good local broadcasting service. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is the community activism that surrounds a good, strong, local broadcast media outlet, much the same as what KQED is doing regionally here. And I was hoping that you guys could kind of address that, and how do we turn the tide and eliminate the homogenization and be able to create some kind of local activism through these national media, perhaps.
Jerry, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Doug Kay, you want to take that on?
Well, I think it's the problem of, again, being hyper-local is one of economics. One advantage of something like podcasting is that the economics allow you to address an infinitely small community, a community of only one or two people even, which is something that neither terrestrial radio or satellite radio or other similar media can possibly go after, if you will.
Part of Jerry's observation was that people get pushed out, Ellen Lee, and so people get marginalized. We don't hear as much from new and aspiring artists because of the homogenization of broadcasting. But in this world, there's room for everyone. The problem, though, is getting noticed, right?
Exactly. It's the wisdom of the crowds, and hopefully that they would be able to recognize who the next, you know, Howard Stern might be. The argument, of course, is with the internet, with the ability for anyone to be a DJ, anyone to be a radio broadcaster, that you could find, for instance, the future Howard Stern or the future Oprah Winfrey through the internet, that it doesn't have to be someone that's worked their way up or gotten their name through the traditional means.
And is that part of what your service, the Conversations Network, provides, Doug Kay, is sort of help in finding what you might be interested in?
We do to some extent. We focus on specifically spoken word content. We typically bring conferences and lectures and things like that to the internet. But I want to mention something that we've skipped over a little bit here, which is we've talked about this push model and we've talked about the pull model, but we haven't really pinned down what's going on in new media, which is a referral model, which is that neither do I sit there passively listening to the content and be surprised, as Wanda said, nor do I particularly go out and seek content, but my friends, the people I work with, my family, send me interesting things.
So it's sort of like the Amazon kind of model, right?
Well, even more active than that, in that it could be someone who sends me an email message that has a YouTube video or a link to a podcast, and that these viral mechanisms of discovering new talent and new content and interesting topics, such as the caller from Olema, you know, who can sit there and exchange topical information with people he works with or communicates with. This is the referral model of discovering new content, and I think that is perhaps one of the important features of new media.
Doug Kay, Executive Director of the Conversations Network. It's an interesting point, Barry Parr, because it's like we all need help here. There's so much out there. You need referrals. You need guides in some ways to help sort it out.
There's no question about that. And one of the things that you find is that over time, people find trusted mechanisms, whether it's blogs that they trust, friends that they trust, you know, via email, referrals, all of those things. And I think that idea of a referral model is a very good one. And it makes a lot of sense about, you know, just the way the internet and new media are beginning to work now.
Let's go next to Mike in Arkansas. Mike, go ahead. You're with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I bet you're joining us on the Sirius Satellite Network, right?
Yes, I am, which I do enjoy. My point I wanted to make with you was when I originally got my satellite radio and making my decision, I got Sirius because it offered the widest range of NPR programming. I'm somewhat miffed by that now as they've dropped PRI. I understand they've dropped Marketplace. I have nowhere really to turn to when I lose those programs because even if the two media companies combine, they're frequency specific, and I can't get my Sirius on an XM without switching equipment. So there's quite an economic cost in switching to over.
Mike, thank you. Thanks for the call. Let's see if we can get an answer. Anyone out there provide some assistance to Mike as he's driving along in his truck in Arkansas about how he's going to continue to be able to get those sort of services if they're no longer part of XM or Sirius?
Well, I think that, this is Doug, I think that if Mike's willing to wait a little bit, he's going to be able to have a portable device which not only is a player of podcasts, but is actually a subscription device that will allow him to subscribe to Marketplace and get it when and where he wants it.
This is Skip. I'd add
those
programs have moved over to XM, and so he could also get them there. Or if this merger goes through, he may be able to, with his existing equipment, find some of those same elements of content shared on both of the services.
In some ways, his concerns as a truck driver driving across Arkansas are an argument for the merger, because it would allow him, if he's a subscriber to one, to have access to the other?
That's possible. We're not sure quite how they're going to do it yet. There would have to the two systems use totally different satellite services, and they would have to continue to supply the content to those legacy receivers. And so we assume that they may cut some of their redundant programming down and keep some of the unique stuff and share it across the two services. We're really not sure how that would work.
Skip Peasy writes a column called The Big Picture for Radio World newspaper. We welcome your participation in our program as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. A couple of our emails coming in, this one from Fairport, New York, someone else listening to us this morning on the Sirius Satellite Network. Paul writes, how will recommenders like Pandora affect radio in general? I see no better way to find new artists that I will like. Is that get back to what you were saying, Doug Kay?
I think so, because, again, it might be a generational thing. We certainly see the trend that younger people are using recommendation systems, or manual recommendation systems, that is much more frequently than people of an older demographic. I think that's a significant change. And they're also looking at much shorter form content. You'll find the YouTube phenomenon, which I keep coming back to, which is people who are looking at things that are just a few minutes long, perhaps, as something that they point their friends to.
John in Roanert Park writes, the argument that the proposed merger will still have plenty of competition is extremely misleading. iPod, internet radio, HD-FM stations are really no competition at all. Internet radio is not available on the road. The iPod has to be uploaded with songs, limiting exposure to what you have to buy, and HD-FM radio is still totally location-dependent. So, Ellen Lee, John would argue that we're saying that there's more out there than there really is.
I think it just depends on how you're going to get it. There's definitely more. It's just different ways each time of how you're going to receive your radio program. To the other point of Pandora, I think what's interesting about that is there's a lot of new technology in terms of music services that are analyzing the underlying, like the algorithms of the music, the different qualities of the music, and giving you recommendations based on that. That's the way Pandora does it. There are a lot of other services that are doing that as well. And it's an interesting technology. It's like the Amazon idea of, if you like this, you might like that. So there's just a lot of exciting ways to discover the new services.
And to Steve next, who joins us this morning in Santa Clara. Steve, go ahead.
Morning, Dave. I have a comment first and then a question. My comment is basically that interactive shows like this will be very, very difficult to do over a podcast. So I'm very pleased that we still have the terrestrial mechanism. But my question is around the convergence of radio and radio over IP and cell phones. The cell phone is a device I take everywhere. It's in my car currently. I'm listening to you guys over the cell phone. My cell phone provider enables me to stream radio and TV over the internet. I have unlimited internet minutes. So if there were more offerings on the internet that are available over the cell phone, I could listen to this show over the internet on my cell phone. So I wouldn't need XM radio in my car. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Steve, thanks. Thanks for calling us this morning. Barry Parr?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with those kinds of wireless networks for things like radio is that the wireless carriers are extremely controlling of the kinds of content that go over their airwaves. And it's really unfortunate because, in fact, if you look at the Internet as a completely distributed and open model, you can see how successful that is, both at creating opportunities and bringing lots of information to individuals. And if you look at the wireless networks, they have not come anywhere near that because they're really trying to control what goes over those airwaves. And, in fact, I think that's a significant problem down the road for that medium.
Dina from Berkeley writes, the merger of the two satellite companies, neither of which has made a profit, is their effort to stay afloat. I don't know anyone besides my son-in-law who subscribes to satellite radio. I'm 53, and everyone I know uses an iPod, listens to NPR and KQED on terrestrial radio, tunes in on their computer, or plays CDs. So, again, this question, Skip Pizzi, about whether or not satellite radio is offering something that people really want.
Well, it is to a certain demographic, that is those that are long-distance drivers, for example, or
yep.
just folks that are mobile, and they can get the same content across the country. It's a national footprint that we've never had in radio before. Also, maybe some of the content in rural areas where you don't have many radio stations to choose from. So there's certainly a service that's being provided. I'd point out, sort of rolling up several of the comments here, that we're moving away from a single platform world for any content provider, terrestrial radio included. You see a number of public stations even and a few commercial stations that have put some pretty rich additional content online. And so the synergy of on-air and online, first of all, it's a great recommendation engine. You can mention your other content that's online on the air, taking the scarce billboard approach on the radio station and driving people to your website. It's ultimately, you could think of your broadcast channel as really a barker channel for all your other services that are provided through other means online. And eventually, hopefully, we'll get away from what Barry's talking about there quite rightly, in that we will just have wireless Internet access that is a last-mile connection to the open Internet, we can hope.
Our truck driver from Arkansas and also our Santa Clara caller mentioned that if it wasn't for this medium that we're currently occupying right now, live at 9:49 in the morning, they wouldn't be able to interact. You can get all of this programming, whether it's Marketplace or Forum, on a podcast. But what we lose, Doug Kay, is the live interactivity. Is that still the principal calling card of old-fashioned terrestrial radio?
That and I think the local proximity. On the other hand, while it's true that you cannot replicate the live experience directly on a podcast, you also reach a potentially significantly larger audience. We do both live streaming and on-demand coverage of events, and we will typically get 100 times more listeners to the on-demand as we get to the live event.
Huh.
And it would be interesting to know, for example, for this show, how many people go and get it from the archives as opposed to actually participate in the original show.
It's true, and I think that's a big challenge that lots of people in our business now have to face, is that sort of basic research task, Barry Parr, to really figure out who the audience is, where they are, and when they're consuming this media.
Well, it's incredibly hard with podcasts because just because a podcast is downloaded doesn't mean that anybody has listened to it. I think as we start
explain that, if you would, just
okay.
for people who aren't fully initiated in this world.
Absolutely. So you can program your computer to download the podcast at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning when you're not at your computer so that it'll be ready for you the next day. And you just may not ever listen to it. It may just sit there until you download the next one and replace it.
So I might think here at KQED, this is fantastic. This forum program that we just did was downloaded by X million people or whatever, X thousand people, but none of them may ever listen to it. So I could delude myself into thinking we have a much bigger audience through podcasting than we really do.
I'm updating podcasts on my iPod weekly that I only listen to when I'm on airplanes.
And let's go to another caller this morning who wants to talk about commercial radio. Go ahead, please. You're on the air. Hi,
hello?
You're with us. Yes, go ahead.
This is Gary.
Gary, go ahead.
I just wanted to state that, when I was growing up, I used to see these bumper stickers saying no pay TV, and these people were protesting the initiation of cable TV, which I thought kind of like they were Luddites. But now my fear is the same in that we will have satellite TV, which is advertising that they have less commercials or no commercials, and then once they get us hooked, they will start commercializing it and knocking out the local TV stations more and more. And
you know, we're going to have the same thing as we have with cable, where the only way you can get content of any diversity is only through satellite. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Gary, thanks. Thanks very much for calling and participating in our program this morning. Skip PC, take that one if you would, the fear of that you're going to have to pay for everything, even old-fashioned, you know, free media. Of course, anyone who watches commercial television knows that you're getting commercials. Anyone who listens to public radio knows that you're getting pledge drives. So in a sense, nothing is free. But what about that concern, that anxiety?
Yeah, content costs money, obviously, to produce and to deliver. These satellite services are particularly expensive, hundreds of millions of dollars in satellites, and they have to be replaced pretty soon. The second-gen satellites are already starting to go up. satellite providers have already started to increase the commercial loads, and I think that's the biggest risk to consumers of this merger, getting back to that question. Not so much the subscription price increases. In fact, we had competition with the two, and in fact, what happened was the cheaper service raised its price to match the more expensive service. And so they're both at parity now, at a higher price than originally. But what is really likely to change isn't so much there's not much elasticity for the pricing to go up, but the number of ads could go up. And it could go up even faster if you're down to just one provider. So I think that's the biggest consumer sort of negative to it. But meanwhile, what satellite radio has done has made terrestrial radio get better. It's made it react. That terrestrial radio needed some competition, I think. When you get these commercial loads that were exceeding 30 minutes an hour in some cases, that's just that tells you you need more competition. And so terrestrial radio has started to reduce its commercial load, add new services, both online and with HD multicasting, and even add title and artist data to their screens of new radios. None of that has had a huge impact yet, but at least you see commercial radio particularly, and even non-commercial radio, reacting in a way that it hadn't and might not have had it not been for satellite radio's competition.
Let's get in one more call, another on the Sirius Satellite Network. Mike joins us from Tampa, Florida. Mike, go ahead.
Hello. I appreciate you taking my call. Much like the other Mike, when I selected my Sirius service over XM, I did it because of the programming for NPR. The local station that we have here has a very limited amount of programming, and it doesn't really fit with my schedule for when I'm in the car. And I think that, you know, that's something that I still value, regardless of whether or not they've scaled back the program. I like the fact that I can listen to NPR at any time and get a wide selection of programs. My concern is with the cost to consumers, to current consumers, subscribers to the service. What is this going to happen? I know that the CEO for Sirius has kicked around in the press. I've seen the number of $26 a month, which is double the cost.
So, let's see if we can get an answer. Mike, thanks very much for the call and the observations. Skip, you were just talking some about the cost impact. Do you suspect, though, it will go up considerably?
It's possible, especially if there's only one provider. Remember, they do have to continue to maintain the service for both systems for at least a long time. They may come up with new radios that would pick up both services.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to try to cut costs only on the content side. They have two separate, very expensive head ends. They'll probably drop that down to one if they were to merge. And I think as a result, the actual offerings will go down, and the price may go up, and the commercial load may go up in the bargain.
Doug Kay, give us a last quick thought, if you would, as we come to the end of our hour here. You're at a gathering in Boston, the Integrated Media Association, that's looking at all these trends. If you had to identify one thing that people, consumers in particular, should sort of keep their eye on, who care about the quality of radio that they listen to, what would it be?
Well, I don't want to be the guy who does the pledge break in the middle of the show, but I think that consumers should consider that to some extent they're going to get what they pay for, and that people should, on the one hand, take advantage of the fact that there's a plethora of offerings that we're going to be going to. I think, as Skip mentioned, some HD radio shortly. But remember that they have a voice in using their pocketbooks, and that should be a big part of how they express what they get.
And Ellen Lee, what do you think is the most interesting thing to keep an eye on in the months and years ahead?
Well, you can't be free, I think in the end, that's the issue that the satellite radio stations have to contend with, that podcasts are free, terrestrial radio is free, and you have your trade-offs. But that's I think that's a key thing for consumers, is how much they're going to have to pay to get their content.
And Barry Parr, you sort out all of this for a business as a research analyst for Jupiter Research. What to you is the most interesting trend to keep an eye on?
Well, I think the most important thing over the next 5 to 10 years is we're going to be entering into a period, we're in a period right now, of tremendous innovation, and that all of these services have advantages over the other services, and we're going to find programming that take advantage of the special characteristics of each medium. And it could be a wrenching period for the established players in terrestrial radio, but I think we're going to see a lot more options and a lot more interesting things and a lot more fun programming down the road.
Barry Parr is senior analyst with Jupiter Research. He joined us this hour along with Skip Pesey, who writes a column called The Big Picture for Radio World newspaper, also manages technical policy at Microsoft in Washington, D.C. Skip, thanks for being part of our program.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Doug Kay joined us as well. He's executive director of the Conversations Network. He joined us from the Integrated Media Association meeting in Washington. Doug, thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for inviting me on.
Happy to have you with us. And Ellen Lee as well, technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have all of you with us on our program this past hour. Forum is produced by Robin Giannotasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer this past hour has been Danny Bringer, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. In the hour ahead, we're going to focus on another interesting form of audio and sound, a new exhibit at the Exploratorium called Listen. That comes up in our second hour. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.